This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Knowing what we know about dwindling energy, the total debt economy, and a dangerously sliding climate, how can anybody talk about hope? I know more people will tune in for the latest disaster news, and there's plenty of that to go around. But this show asks three really smart people how we could tilt all that into worthwhile good lives on a good planet. These aren't Pollyannas or professional spin masters. Our guests are famous in their fields. They've been around the block with human disgrace and our attack on nature. After publishing The Population Bomb, written with his wife Anne, Paul R. Ehrlich remains an essential public figure 50 years later. He's the Bing Professor of Population Studies at Stanford University and president of Stanford Center for Conservation Biology. Ehrlich teamed up with the green giant of filmmaking for the new book, Hope on Earth, A Conversation. The other end of that talk is Michael Charles Tobias. You have seen his work on TV and films, whether you know his name or not. Animal rights activists respect his work too. Basically, I grill them both, first about the real-world situation, everything from the Ukraine to the climate and onward to the economy, and then how can they find any self-respecting hope? After that, we veer off into the improbable, climate humor. We'll talk with a professional stand-up economist about climate change and comedy. Yoram Bowman has been on Comedy Central, does stand-up tours, and just co-authored a new book, The Cartoon Introduction to Climate Change. Hey, you know it's global warming when Middle East oil producers feel at home everywhere. Hot water comes out of both taps. You find out asphalt has a liquid state. The four seasons are tolerable, hot, really hot, and are you kidding me? It's your long-lost hope and desperate laughs right here on Radio EcoShock. After publishing The Population Bomb, written with his wife Anne, Paul R. Ehrlich has combined a lifetime of science, education, and public dialogue. Paul is the Bing Professor of Population Studies at Stanford University and president of Stanford Center for Conservation Biology. Now Dr. Ehrlich has published a new book with another giant of ecology and communication, Michael Charles Tobias. It's a long-running dialogue which ends up at the improbable station of optimism, I think. We'll have to ask Paul about that. It's called Hope on Earth, A Conversation. Paul Ehrlich, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Great to be back.
So, the title is about hope. It's almost a cursed word after the disappointment of some with the Obama campaign. Is hope a damaged word, and what should we hope for?
I think hope is a damaged word, but one still has to have hope. In other words, my great hope is that society will undergo an unexpected but not totally unusual transformation in which we begin to face our problems squarely and do something about them. There's no mystery about what's going on in the world. We know there are many too many people and that we're going to have to humanely reduce the population size over the next 50 to 75 years. We know that many people, not all, are consuming too much, and many people don't have enough to consume, and that we know how to fix as well. We've done it in the past. But the issue is, can we get going, or are we going to sort of be pushed under by the people who believe that you can grow forever with no consequences? And you know, if you look historically, there have been occasions when societies have changed dramatically quickly. The U.S. changed dramatically quickly in 1941 after the attack on Pearl Harbor. The whole Russian system, the red communist system, collapsed. The Soviet Union disappeared when it wasn't expected to. So societies can change rapidly, but boy, do we really need rapid change now.
In your new book, I was surprised to find discussions about butterflies and bugs as well until I dug into your serious qualifications as an entomologist. I wonder, are we a little like insects in some ways?
Well, we certainly have the same kind of population dynamics, namely the same rules that govern how big an insect population, say, of insect pests is going to be are the same basic rules that determine how big a population human beings who we're going to have. It's an issue of input and output. How many births and immigrants do you have versus how many deaths and emigrants do you have? So the basic numbers are the same. And, of course, insects are, like us, dramatically affected by climate, and insects compete with us for food. And insects are ideal experimental systems to understand how the world works. And we know a lot about how the world works, and scientists have told the public a lot about how the world works. And right now, the public, at least in the United States, is paying very little attention.
Well, thinking of warring ants, what do you make of the resurrection of the Cold War with the United States and its allies against Russia and maybe China?
Well, I think it's a supremely stupid move. First of all, Russia's sphere of influence obviously ought to include the Ukraine and Sevastopol and places that were part of Russia before. We broke our promise to them that we wouldn't shove NATO at them. This is it's all got to do with an insane battle over oil and natural gas, two things that we should not be burning. As the head of the U.S. Bank pointed out, Iraq was over oil. Afghanistan's over oil and gas. We have CENTCOM, which is our military part of our empire, to try and control Central Asia. We have AFRICOM, which is designed to try and control the oil of Africa. And it's doubly insane because, of course, every scientist knows that we have to stop using oil and as quickly as possible also natural gas. Otherwise, we're going to see a collapse of civilization from the destruction of our life support systems as climate disruption gets worse and worse and worse. So, you know, fighting the Russians or Chinese over oil would be like if we were starving, fighting them over cyanide to eat. We've got to cooperate with the Russians and Chinese to try and solve the gigantic global problems, not just climate change, but the toxification of the entire planet, the increasing danger of huge epidemics, and, of course, the danger of resource wars, which could go nuclear, and which, for instance, if it went nuclear between India and Pakistan over their water problems having to do with climate change, it would destroy the United States and Russia as well. So we have great joint things that we've got to do with Russia and China. And the whole business over the Ukraine is fundamentally stupid foreign policy, largely on the part of the United States, although I'm not an admirer of Putin either.
It's strange. We talk about globalization as fine for the economy, as fine for corporations, but not a good idea when it comes to solving these common problems like what are we going to do about dumping in the atmosphere or how are we going to save the oceans from their problems?
No, absolutely. It's really nutty because the globalization – we should go back to the thinking of the founders of the United States when they had the great debates over the new Constitution, the Federalists versus the Anti-Federalists. And their questions really were, how do we retain ourselves as separate states with separate, often religions and history sometimes fighting with each other, but how do we solve our common problems? And their common problems were things like, what if the British should come back? Our common problems are the states of the nation states of the world is how can we possibly solve climate disruption and toxics and so on. And many of the issues that our founding fathers faced trying to get the diverse colonies together are the same ones we need to face in order to get the diverse nation states together. We cannot solve these problems as individual nations. They must be solved jointly. And that means the nation state as the functional unit to do it has become obsolete. And we've got to find ways to replace it.
You know, on a personal level, Paul Ehrlich, we may share one thing in common. My mother spoke and wrote classical Greek and Latin, and it shook me out of that idea, common at the time, that women were not smart enough to run corporations or governments. Do you think a greater role for women is part of that hope for the future?
Oh, I think it's absolutely central. If you want to solve the population problem, first of all, the problem of consumption can be solved very rapidly, but population can only be solved humanely in a relatively slow manner, and that means giving women totally equal rights and equal opportunities around the planet, and giving everybody who's sexually active access to modern contraception and backup abortion. Anybody who's against that is entirely unethical. All it does is kill women and ruin the world for our descendants. There are many, many people who are having more children than they want, and they don't have the capacity to limit them. So give women rights and the birth rate will go down. Give everybody access to contraception and abortion and the birth rate will go down. And we might actually save humanity. It's a great hope.
So, Paul, you're almost 82. Is this book, Hope on Earth, partly a summary of your life's thought?
Oh, no, I barely started. I mean, I'm not retired. I'm meeting with an administrator about my chairmanship tomorrow. In a couple hours. So, no, I'm just going. They're not going to get rid of me that easily.
I didn't think so. You know, it would be great if you could live to be 140 to see whether your predictions about the population you and Anne made back in the 1960s come true, or are they already coming true?
Well, I think they're already coming true, but I would love to see what it's like in 2030, but just briefly. But I'm going to be shot when I'm 106 by a jealous husband, so I don't worry about that.
Paul, it feels like, though, to be serious, that we are in a triage ward of issues that demand immediate attention, the species, the forests, the oceans, the climate. How can our listeners decide where to focus, what they should be working on?
Well, happily, virtually anything that will help society will help the whole problem. But you should go to mahb.stanford.edu. That's mahb.stanford.edu. Join the mob. It takes 2 minutes and costs nothing, and contribute to figuring out how we're going to do it. If your issue is women's rights, you'll help with the environment. If your issue is the environment, you'll help with women's rights and racism. It all ties together into one hideous mess, which is an advantage because as social animals, we can get together and solve these problems. The problem is that civil society isn't coordinated enough to get the job done, and that's what we need. We need better civil society looking forward and moving in the right direction, and you can help.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with the famous author and professor Paul R. Ehrlich. We're talking about his new book, Hope on Earth. In past weeks, we received dire news about the planet. NASA scientists say the melting of glaciers in Antarctica is unstoppable, and so is sea level rise. It's hard work to hope in those times, don't you think?
Well, it's hard work to hope, but again, if we can transition away from the use of fossil fuels, we can limit the damage. And fortunately, sea level rise will be relatively slow. Much more dangerous is the impact of changing precipitation patterns and so on our agricultural system. Remember, we've already got over 800 million people starving on this planet. We've got 2 billion that are micronutrient malnourished. That is, they have problems functioning because they don't get the proper balance in their diet. And by the way, a paper that came out of the Stanford of the East, Harvard University, just demonstrated that as you put more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the nutritive value, the nutritional value of our crops declines, which is a very sad sign. But you change the patterns of precipitation, you make the world warmer, you have more and more difficulty getting enough food to feed everybody, which we don't do today. In other words, we need much more food to take care of the people who are already hungry, and people are talking about adding 2.5 billion people to the planet by 2050. That's many more people than were alive on the entire planet when I was born in 1932. That's not wise. And again, sea level rise will affect hundreds of millions of people, but the climate's effects on agriculture are likely to affect many billion people, and that's an even more serious problem.
So in this book, you're not afraid to light a few firecrackers, and I want to talk about the ultimate hope for Christians and Muslims as they want to find a better world after they die in heaven, and some extremists even hope the world will end, whatever that means. What can science offer as a rational view against that?
Well, science can tell you exactly, precisely what it's like after you're dead, and everybody knows it, and it's exactly like it was before you were born. We are in a period now that some people call the Endarkenment. The Enlightenment era has sort of come to an end, and we're moving from a world in which people made decisions on the basis of evidence, that was the Enlightenment, back to a position where people make decisions on the basis of faith. And as we have seen in many, 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 many instances, faith is a miserable way to make decisions. If you have faith that somebody will save you if you drive your car 200 miles an hour into a wall, good luck. It's much better to work on evidence if people want to have a decent world. And I think everybody wants to have a decent world. It's sad that the education levels are so low that people believe the world the universe is actually created and run by a supernatural monster. There are 300 sextillion stars. That's more stars in the universe than there are grains of sand on all of Earth's beaches. More stars than grains of sand everywhere. And some people actually believe that the stars and all were created by a monster that still retains a deep interest in your personal sex life. It's an amazing thought. And yet we require our politicians to at least pretend they believe in stuff like that. So the answer is, you want to save the world, have any faith you want, but operate on evidence and do the things that will give your children and grandchildren a real chance to have a decent life. Because that's what we're stealing the world from. We're stealing the world from our descendants, and that's not ethical in any religion.
Well, you've worked on population perhaps more than anybody, and I'm wondering, is it possible religion is really an expression of our genetic need deep in our genes to reproduce ourselves as much as we can?
Well, there's no question that that's programmed into our DNA, but there's also no question we easily override it. In other words, I've surveyed many audiences now, over 14,000 women, and I've never found a single one who either had or planned to have more than 25 children, even though that's possible. Every society we know has always limited their reproduction. They do it in various ways, but it's still limited. Nobody has the maximum number of, no entire society has the maximum number of children. So it is certainly, all of us love children. We are designed by evolution, unlike chimpanzees, for instance, to love other people's children. We're the only big primate that actually will, for instance, wet nurse. In other words, no chimpanzee ever lets another chimpanzee nurse their child or hold it because they're afraid it'll be killed. But human babies were designed to attract other people. If you bring a newborn baby into the studio, I guarantee you that the women there will start building nests and will switch, as will the men, to baby talk, to what's called mother ease. So they say, ooh, goo, 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 goo. We really relate to kids, and that's an important thing. I just wish people would start relating more to kids, not in terms of how many do I want, but what kind of world are the children I know going to live in, my children and my friends' children and my relatives' children, because they're all wonderful, and it's really easy to bond to other people's children. We were designed that way.
In 2013, you wrote and spoke widely about a very serious question: can a collapse of global civilization be avoided? Do you have any further thoughts on that now?
Well, actually, that's been out there. Of course, the scientific community reviewed the article and everything, and I'm sad to say that my colleagues all agreed with it, and there's been no major change. In other words, it has not. After all, when the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, announced its big thing about 3 months ago, the evening news on NBC gave more space to the story that a Dodger baseball pitcher was retiring than they did this from saying that the scientific community said we're on the road to a collapse of civilization. In other words, it's not news. As one of my colleagues said about the situation in Australia, where education is as bad as it is here, any society whose major values are mall crawling and sports is never going to have a decent education system. And you're not going to have people intelligent enough to know what's really news and what is trivial. And we have a terrible situation with the media. We're moving into an oligarchy, as you know. For instance, everybody's vote in the United States today is worth about a third of what it was when I was born, because it's a representative government. And as Madison noted in the 1790s, the big problem with increased population size is it wrecks any form of representative government or democracy, because your vote is deteriorating. And of course, now, with the Supreme Court, you don't have any real vote anymore anyway. It's an oligarchy run by the corporations. You know, the best politicians money can buy.
Could you tell us about one of the settings of this book and your life, the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory? What is it and what goes on there?
Well, it's a laboratory that's run like a university. It's private in that sense. It has a board and charges. people, and it what goes on there is research on what goes on in the natural world. It's the best terrestrial field laboratory. It's high in the Rockies. My most interesting experiment is by a colleague of mine named John Hart, who has been heating some of the meadows about 2 degrees above normal for the last 23 years. And he's had plots that are heated and plots that are control plots that aren't heated. And the dramatic thing is, first of all, in his heated plots, the carbon has been disappearing from the soil, which is extremely frightening because, of course, it goes into the atmosphere and there's more carbon in the soil than there is now in the atmosphere. And if we dump the soil carbon into the atmosphere, it's going to make climate change much, much worse. But even more dramatically, he has no controls anymore because the plots he didn't heat have been following the ones that were heated. The natural warming of the climate has gotten onto his plots and is making the same things happen in them as happened 20 years ago when he put artificial heat on them. So the lab is a wonderful place. It's a great group of scientists doing important work. And it's been one of the great pleasures of my life to do my research out there virtually every summer.
Is there anything else on your mind that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, don't give up hope. Join the mob. Realize that things can change very, very rapidly. Realize that we have to treat not just our environment, but all our other fellow human beings the same way. We can differ greatly in all sorts of things. That's one of the great things about being a human being. And we settle them by discussion, and we need discussion. We need to talk about ethics. One of the things that you don't hear is it ethical for us not to do anything about climate disruption because we think that people are going to be richer in the future? Are they going to be richer in the future? Maybe they're going to be poorer. Then what should we do? We need a lot more discussion of sensible things and a lot less nonsense from the Tea Party and Rush Limbaugh and other assorted idiots.
We've been honored to have as our guest biologist, author, and Stanford professor Paul R. Ehrlich. And we've been talking about his new book, Hope on Earth, A Conversation with Michael Charles Tobias. Thank you for talking with us, Paul.
My great pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. He's an author, a true ecologist, mountain climber. You've probably seen his work as a filmmaker. Michael Charles Tobias created the 1991 Voice of the Planet series for Turner Broadcasting, with William Shatner as host, no less. He's done a slew of documentaries since then, including Hotspots for PBS. Tobias is equally well known, though, in the animal rights and conservation movement, where he's received awards and accolades for his work. He leads the Dancing Star Foundation, devoted to species preservation. Now, Michael has teamed up with Stanford's Dr. Paul Ehrlich for a deep conversation in the book Hope on Earth. Michael, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. I'm really honored to be on your show, Alex.
California's been burning, temperature records falling. Surely people there must be wondering whether it's climate change and whether the state will be so pleasant if the world gets hotter. What are you hearing?
Well, of course, there's not a kid on the block who hasn't heard the phrase climate change. The nuances, of course, are myriad, but we're all now part of a singular issue, which, as Al Gore said years ago, is the issue of the 21st century, namely ecological literacy and survival. So everyone's talking about it. Everyone's part of the problem. Everyone can be part of the solution.
And people are still buying new cars, new trucks. They're going for oil in the most extreme places. Do you have any ideas when this deadly bubble will either pop or turn around?
Interesting question, Alex. I mean, let's look at British Columbia for a second. You have one of the lowest fertility rates in the world, certainly the lowest in Canada, just over 1.4. And yet you've got one of the worst legacies of watershed destruction in any country on the planet. You've got two out of the three most endangered mammals in North America in British Columbia, and yet a very small population growth. That said, like Tasmania, I mean, British Columbia has had a fantastic record in terms of Green Party politics, in terms of environmental awareness, and yet with 94% of your land owned by the Crown, you've not been able to protect very well the Ursus Americanus Kermode, the spirit bear, which numbers in the wild well over 400, and of course the Vancouver Island marmot, Marmota vancouverensis, which is probably, after the Pacific pocket mouse here in Southern California, the most endangered mammal in North America. So there are strange contradictions in terms of when the bubble will burst, what kinds of corollaries and equations and extrapolations we're making with respect to the impact that all of us consumers have. I can't answer it in terms of when. I can certainly, and I'm happy to discuss some of the potential outcomes of the crisis we all find ourselves in.
Before we get to that, how did you hook up with Paul Ehrlich?
Paul and I have known each other for a long time. He's been in three films that I've directed, and we share and have shared really since the 60s, although he's about 20 years older than I am, a deep, deep commitment to finding practical solutions to very gnarly and seemingly intractable problems vis-a-vis human nature and our impact on the global commons. So we first met face-to-face in the early 80s when I did a short documentary on extinction that included he and his wife, Ann Ehrlich, who had written a very good book on extinction with that title. Then we did a project, I directed a feature film called No Vacancy. Paul had a very important appearance in that film. Then we did a three-hour series that Dancing Star produced called State of the Earth. He and John Hart, who appears at the end of our book from UC Berkeley, a brilliant scientist, that's what sort of triggered the idea that Paul and I should actually do a book together. And the notion of a conversation, as Jared Diamond said in his lovely back cover comment, really is a platonic ideal to bring out, you know, the different prospects that two individuals with very different attitudes and orientations but common themes might be able to share and shed light on.
Both of you have done some work about human population, but the thing that bugs me is that almost all of the population discussions are about what humans are doing for humans, and the animals are just left out of the equation and what's happening to them. Is there anybody speaking about overpopulation versus animals?
I have for 40 years, and at least 30 books of mine and probably 40 or 50 films of mine, and all the colleagues of mine who have been in those projects, part of those projects, most notably my wife and partner, Jane Grey Morrison, and this is what Dancing Star Foundation does. I think a lot of people, including organizations like World Watch, have focused heavily on impacts. I think you're right to say, and I would conclude and agree with you, that very few are making the connection between population, the human species, this traditional, almost religiously inbred notion of our superiority over the rest of the creation, and animal rights. I'm deeply focused, Dancing Star Foundation is deeply focused on that issue. And I'm happy to say that even randomly you might think, but not so, this week's Fortune magazine, in their article on water, very boldly puts up front the price of a cheeseburger in terms of water, 968 gallons. Now, that may seem suddenly, well, what does that have to do with animals and animal rights or other species? Of course, it has everything to do with other species, because the vast majority of that water abstraction is going into raising mammals, in this case, bovines, that will be slaughtered for consumption, human consumption. And we've always put that under the table. You know, it's been said many, many times by colleagues of mine like Ingrid Newkirk and many others, Mark Beckoff, Jane Goodall, that, you know, if there were windows on every slaughterhouse in the world, that would be it. People would stop eating meat. I don't know if that's true or not, because we just heard a statistic in the last couple of days that came from the Anti-Defamation League suggesting that in a very comprehensive poll of over 110 countries, more than 51% of those surveyed said that, in their belief, there was no Holocaust in World War II. It was made up, that Anne Frank was a hoax. So if the most outrageous, horrific atrocity in documented human history is now believed by the majority of human beings to be a myth, what are we to make about their potential for ameliorating suffering when it comes to the more than 100 billion, that's with a B as in boy, 100 billion animals that are slaughtered for our unnecessary convenience and or taste bud pleasure, our quick fix, if you will, annually. I mean, this is a really critical core issue. And that's really why Paul Ehrlich and I, in our book Hope on Earth, started out with this Parmenides kind of Platonic dialogue, which really is about the one versus the many. And how do you reconcile the wishes of the one versus the needs of the many?
Well, you raised so many issues I'd like to take up there. I mean, just for example, I look up overpopulation on YouTube, and right at the top are a whole series of people, starting with talk show bad boy Alex Jones, saying overpopulation is a myth designed to exert global control. And so what is it about humans? We lie to ourselves about the most obvious things, whether it's population, what's happening to the animals, global warming. And the fringe deniers seem to get as many viewers and listeners as the sane people do. It's very frustrating.
Well, look at your own country. I mean, Canada, for the third year in a row, as all of your listeners will know, has seen its total fertility rate, the number of kids being born per couple, declining to a national average, I believe, of about 1.63, something like that. And BC is number one after I think, Newfoundland and Nova Scotia. So the commentators I've read on the Canadian front are all in unison with regard to, oh, dear, we're not replacing ourselves. We're going to have a gigantic crisis with regard to the social security net, with regard to supply demand and workers in the workforce, et cetera, et cetera. All the same issues you're seeing in the million shades of gray, so to speak, in Japan and China and throughout parts of Europe. Well, I mean, we have gone from the time of Karl Marx in 1850 to the present. We have multiplied ourselves well over sevenfold. Even at the medium level, United Nations projections, we will hit 9.5 billion by mid-century. If we continue at present trends, notwithstanding the great fertility restraint in British Columbia and Albania and a few places like that, we're going to exceed 12 to 13 billion Homo sapiens, which is odd because, you know, sapiens suggests that we're really smart as primates, but in fact, we're really self-destructive. Because everyone, and you can't blame them, we all want the same thing. We want cool air, the solace of shade under a tree. We want fresh drinking water. We want a quality of life. We want dignity. We want employment. We want a number of things. And everyone wants the same thing. We are genetically the same. We're one. So those who would argue that overpopulation is a non-issue, and they do, in fact, as you point out, Alex, dominate the world media. They dominate economic thinking. I like to recall one of my favorite philosophers, Bertrand Russell, who once said that most Americans, for example, would rather commit suicide than learn about mathematics. People don't want to learn about the numbers. And in fact, neurologists who've studied the brain have come up with the conclusion that we're much better at adding numbers than subtracting numbers. So it's much easier to add up 1 + 1 than to subtract 1 + 1 for some reason. So we're not good at looking at the opportunities of shrinking our population. We're much better at figuring out how many more cars can be sold if we have another million consumers. This is a big problem.
It sure is. Well, now this leads us to your book about Hope on Earth. And you told me that you were thinking about putting a question mark after that title. Why didn't you?
I think both Paul Ehrlich and myself are of the opinion that we want to encourage, inspire, hopefully enthrall people, colleagues, friends, newcomers to the work, as opposed to undermining and daunting and chilling them to the point of inertia. There'd be no point you and I having this conversation if we thought there was no hope. But it is a point of conversation. It is not a done deal. And hence, the question mark is a very reasonable concept because we've got a lot of work to do. The tipping points are happening from the boreal forests in Canada to the Antarctic. We're seeing the demise of the largest number of species in the documented annals of biology, which is 4.1 billion years. We're also seeing the largest loss of species per year. Approximately 16 million populations are going extinct every year. That means a pod of whales or a flock of birds. So it's not just the hundreds and hundreds of species that are going extinct every day. We don't even know how many. But the question mark is this. If you are of the belief, as I am, and I know Paul is, that biodiversity is critical, that as Aristotle echoed in his whole body of works, he was, after all, a brilliant and one of the first great biologists in Western history, if the Earth is our mother, we came from her, we will return to her, that's for sure, then we need to revere her, we need to honor her, we need to give back, not just take. And we are a species of bipedal carnivorous Homo sapiens, one of the most heavy, if not the heaviest impact species in history, who may have the shortest epitaph in history, which is a curious paradox. It's the paradox of progress. It's the tragedy of the commons, as biologist Garrett Hardin at UC Santa Barbara said in 1968 in one of the most heavily cited papers and phrases in the history of ecology. We really need to revere every living species. Sentience matters. And why I believe there is hope in the midst of this absolutely insane crisis that we're up against, that we're causing singularly, the hope is vested in the fact that never before have so many people wanted to be part of the solution. So you could look at the flip side of the population explosion and say, hey, look, we've got a billion young people now who want to be philanthropists, who want to make a difference, who want to emulate the Bill and Melinda Gateses of the world and really try to solve these major issues that are afflicting so many living beings, not just our own species. And that's really the bottom line.
Yeah, that word hope has been so abused. Some people actually turn away from anybody talking about it, much less promising it. And, you know, you'd sell more books if you called it the catastrophe that's coming or something. But I wonder, when we talk to young people, and I'm sure you do, what kind of hope can we offer them?
Any 8-year-old, any 6-year-old, any 4-year-old, really, can become a philanthropist. And they are. When they extend their olive branch in the form of helping someone across the street, saving a friend from getting hurt or hit on the head, they are, in fact, replicating, I believe, that compassion which is hardwired into us. I'm a firm believer in the notion that commensalism, symbiosis, biophilia, physiolatry, the love of nature, all of the good things that human nature does espouse and has espoused since time immemorial are real. If you go back to northern Iraq, as it is today, geopolitically, and look at Shanidar 4, one of the cave sites 60,000 years ago, it's the earliest known evidence of what we call conscience, or what the Greeks knew as synderesis, the act of compassion. There's a person, a skull, that was found in the 50s by a group from Columbia University in New York with a tiara of dried wildflowers on the skull. It's very likely that a son buried his father and put flowers on his head 62,000 years ago. We're capable of Bach's St. Matthew Passion, of Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel, of Vermeer's Girl with a Pearl Earring, of chocolate chip cookies and frisbees. And I really believe that the soul speaks when it's spoken to, and children give their best when given a chance. And evolution, by the way, in my opinion, does not condemn or liberate us. Only our choices can do that. So if we can raise a young generation of people who are focused on nonviolence or ahimsa, on compassion, I mean, we've experimented with war and violence and techniques of violence for thousands of years. It's time to explore and teach nonviolence. And that's what environmentalism is about. It's not just about housekeeping, if you want to transliterate the Greek. It's really about nonviolence, and that means to every living creature. It may seem symbolic at times if you save a spider from the bathtub, but it's not just symbolic. It's very real to that spider, and that's my point. Biodiversity has a conscience. Animals are self-aware. They dream. They're brilliant. We don't know that they're not infinitely smarter than we are. They certainly have caudal tails and residual stories, and they're not just biologies, they're biographies. And when we really understand and feel that, I think it's going to redirect the climate talks in Paris, for example, at the end of 2015. It's going to redirect our ethical address of what we're doing as a singular species to this planet. And so if you reach out to every individual life form that you encounter in any given day and decide, okay, that crow is my friend, that worm, that nameless little worm is my friend. If we take that attitude, I think the whole world could be different.
I'm going to go with what you said. Do you have a website, a Facebook page, or a Twitter feed that people can follow?
Absolutely. www.dancingstarfoundation.org. And my personal website is www.michaeltobias.org. And I would welcome, we certainly welcome donations at our foundation based in California and New Zealand. And we certainly welcome dialogue and invigorating ideas for solutions. We do give out grants here and there, but we're primarily an operating foundation. We have rescued animals on our sanctuaries, and we're rescuing endangered species in places like New Zealand, where we operate a scientific reserve adjoining the newest national park on Rokiura, or Stewart Island, the third major island of New Zealand. But yeah, that's how people can reach me.
Well, I'm going to put some links to all of that and some YouTube videos that you've done in my own blog at ecoshock.info, and I think people will follow up that way too. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with filmmaker, ecologist, and animal defender Michael Charles Tobias about the new book Hope on Earth, A Conversation, co-authored with Stanford's Paul Ehrlich. Michael is president of the Dancing Star Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us. I've really enjoyed what you had to say.
Alex, it's an honor to be your guest.
Radio EcoShock.
Our next guest is an economist who has assessed climate change. But wait, before you hit the snooze button, Dr. Yoram Bauman bills himself as the world's first and only stand-up economist. He tours the country doing comedy gigs that connect with ordinary people, explaining pretty difficult concepts. I suppose it's appropriate that from Comedy Central, Yoram has moved on to publish a book on global warming, all in cartoons. I'll do anything to reach the public, and so will Yoram, so let's do it. Let's dare to talk about the economics of destroying the world's climate. Yoram Bauman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much.
How do you overcome that first hurdle, getting people to stay for your shows once they find out you really are an economist?
Oh, I guess that's a fine question. Well, I bill myself as the world's first and only stand-up economist, so I promise people, and I actually deliver a good time. So we have a bunch of laughs, and then talk about economics, and then spend a little bit of time talking a little more seriously about climate change issues.
And we have a lot of lawyer jokes. Are there economist jokes?
Absolutely. So, believe it or not, I actually make a living doing stand-up comedy about economics. And what I've found is that anytime there are sort of strong stereotypes about something, you can get comedy out of it. So there are stereotypes about economics and economists, that it's boring, that we're money-grubbing. And so you end up with jokes like, you might be an economist if you don't read human interest stories because they don't interest you. Or if you think that supply and demand is a good answer to questions like, where do babies come from?
I like it. What brought you to add climate change to your act?
It was actually there sort of from the beginning. So the reason I went to graduate school and got a PhD in economics was to work on climate change economics, environmental taxes. Basically, I work on what's called environmental tax reform. So the idea that we should have higher taxes on pollution, like carbon emissions, and then use the revenue to reduce taxes on things that we would like more of. So jobs and income and savings and investment. This is an idea that actually economists kind of across the political spectrum think is a pretty swell idea. The challenge is really communicating that idea and getting support among the general public and the legislature, and so comedy was kind of an interesting new way to communicate with people about this, and it started off as a hobby for me while I was in graduate school and ended up becoming my career.
So about 8 years ago in Britain, we had the Stern Report, and since then a series of reports and papers where serious people try to compare the cost of trying to avert a climate disaster versus just going ahead with burning all the fossil fuels we can find. Are these economic reports worthy of our attention?
I think that the top line of them certainly is. I think if you dig down into it, you'll find a lot of disagreement from economists, about kind of the details. If you have two economists in a room, you'll get three opinions, that sort of thing. But I think that there's pretty broad agreement on the top ranks, which is that, you know, climate change is real. It's an important issue that we need to think about in the years ahead, and there are smart economic tools that we can use to help address the problem. Things like this revenue neutral carbon tax idea that I mentioned, where we could have higher taxes on bad things and lower taxes on good things.
I wonder if there's much hope for a big breakthrough in government, or is it going to be small incremental things that maybe happen at the municipal or state levels? What are you seeing?
Well, I'm here in Washington State in Seattle, and there's a lot of energy and enthusiasm right now about carbon pricing in particular and climate action in Washington and Oregon and along the West Coast of the U.S. and Canada. So British Columbia has a terrific carbon tax that I would argue is the best climate policy in the world. California has a cap-and-trade system, and Washington and Oregon are in between, and there's a lot of pressure and enthusiasm in both states for sort of pursuing carbon pricing in one of those two forms, either a BC-style carbon tax or a California-style cap-and-trade system. I think that, you know, pushing something at the national level in the U.S. is going to be a little harder. The same thing is true in Canada. Europe is dealing with, you know, various economic calamities. So I think that national and international action is going to be a little slower. I think there's a good chance that we'll see some strong and promising developments sort of at the state and provincial level in the next couple of years.
So before we get to your new book, The Cartoon Introduction to Climate Change, I'd like to ask you about one awful excuse for accepting climate change as just a cost of our wonderful civilization. It's the broken window theory that repairing climate damage actually adds to the gross domestic product. Is that real or is that a joke?
So I think you're talking about this idea that if, let's say, a hurricane destroys a coastal city, then there will be some economic activity associated with rebuilding that destroyed city. So I suppose as an economist, I would say that that's true. But if you think about the alternative, if we hadn't destroyed the city, if the hurricane hadn't destroyed the city, then all of that economic activity, all those jobs, all those people, all those materials would have been available to do something else. So I think the underlying economic point is that, you know, if we don't go around destroying our cities and suffering from climate damages, then we'll have an opportunity to put those economic powers, those economic resources, to better use somewhere else. So I mostly don't think that that's a terribly cogent argument.
And, you know, my theory, Yoram, is that climate change, just like the impacts of all the extreme weather events, will eventually wear us down and could cause an economic crash, the likes of which we haven't seen before. Isn't it possible we could run out of wealth to rebuild?
It's certainly true that if we push the climate system, if we continue to push the climate system, then we're going to end up in a world that we're sort of unfamiliar with. And it's not entirely clear exactly what's going to happen there because we haven't experienced a world like that. So it's this ongoing experiment on the planet. And although climate scientists are awfully smart folks, there's a limit to how much we know about what's going to happen if we push past 400 parts per million to 500, 600, 1,000. So I think a lot of the way economists think about this is as a risk issue. There's uncertainty about what's going to happen. There's uncertainty about how well we could adapt. And we should take smart actions to avoid having to deal with that risk. So climate action in that perspective is sort of like an insurance policy. You know, if we take smart action now, then we can avoid the possibility that our planet is going to, quote unquote, crash and burn. That's basically why you buy car insurance, and that's why you can buy some planet insurance.
Yeah, you've talked about planetary insurance policies, and I think people can understand that. I mean, I have insurance on my car and my possessions. Surely, if there's a way to protect planet Earth, maybe we should do it.
I would agree with you, and I think the vast majority of economists around the world would agree as well. You know, and there are smart things that we can do that aren't going to cost all that much. The way we describe it in the cartoon book is that if we give up a kind of a small piece of cake, a small piece of our economic activity, then we can get peace of mind. And that's why you buy car insurance, and that's why we should do smart things to deal with climate change.
Well, getting to the book, you've got some fine YouTube live acts and such. Why turn to the media of cartoons for such a serious subject?
Well, my co-author and I have actually written two cartoon economics books. So Grady Klein is my co-author, and he's the illustrator. And the economics books were both successes. They were both a lot of fun to work on. And since climate change is my focus area when I do serious economic work and activism, I thought it would be a great topic for our third cartoon book. I think it's also true that there's a little bit of a barrier where, you know, folks who care about climate change, there are a lot of books out there for folks who care about climate change, you know, up to and including the multi-thousand page IPCC report that came out over the last year or so. But for folks who don't care all that much about climate change, it can be a little daunting to pick up, you know, kind of a gloom and doom tome or the latest Bill McKibben book, just because people don't necessarily want to be confronted with that sort of bad news, you know, with the idea that, hey, you know, this is a serious issue and we need to do something about it. So I think the medium of cartooning is, it's accessible, it's fun, it's entertaining, there are some jokes in there as well as a bunch of serious content, and it's really a strong way to reach out to people, to people who aren't sort of intrinsically or immediately interested in climate change. So it's a way to connect to them in the same way I think that stand-up comedy is sort of a way to connect to new audiences. So that's one of the things that I'm really excited about with the book, is that it can be something that folks who care about climate change can use to give to friends, neighbors, family members who don't necessarily care all that much about climate change. And it can be a way to start the conversation and say, hey, here's something that I think is an important issue, and here's sort of some of the basic concepts and issues involved, and let's talk about it.
Well, and I think people have moved more towards video and images and away from the printed word to some degree. There are fewer people willing to read a long book about any subject, so it might work that way. The other advantage I was thinking is, and I noticed your earlier cartoon books were translated in many languages, it's easier to translate. People around the world can identify with a cartoon.
That's certainly true, yeah. So the Cartoon Econ books have been translated into, I think, about 12 languages now, including Mongolian. So that's super exciting, and since climate change, you know, is an international problem, it would be great if there were some international translations of this book, too. I sometimes talk about what I call, I'm very proud of this, this is my own theory, I call it the Five Chinas theory of the world, and it says that you can take the world population of 7 billion, you divide by 5, you get 1.4 billion, which is approximately the population of China. Right, so you can divide the world population into these five China-sized chunks, and we talk about this in the cartoon book as well. So China, India, the third China is everybody else in developing Asia, so there's a lot of people in Asia. The fourth China is the rich world, so you add up everybody in North America, Europe, Japan, put them all together, about the same population as China. And the fifth China is principally Africa and South America. So you look at those five Chinas, and at the beginning of this century, the rich world was responsible for about half of world CO2 emissions. And at the end of this century, it's going to be very different because of growth in China, because of growth in India, hopefully because of growth in Africa. And there are lots of positives to that story. But I think, you know, the other big story of this century is going to be dealing with the environmental impacts of having 7 billion people growing to 10 or 11 billion people who are all trying to live the lifestyles that, you know, that we live here.
That's going to be a problem. You know, I went to your website at standupeconomist.com, and one thing I couldn't help but notice is you become a spokesman for the Ford Transit Connect. Selling a gas car seems like a disconnect to me when we need to move away from burning carbon. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I appreciate the question. It was something that I thought about before I did it. I'll say a couple of things about this. First of all, I could make the usual sort of stories that it's a fuel-efficient small business van, but I think the deeper point is really that we are not at a point right now where we are going to get away from fossil fuels immediately. It's not like we're going to stop buying cars and trucks tomorrow. What we need to do is we need to have smart policies in place that are going to push us in a different direction over the decades ahead. I'll give you a perfect example. My wife and I are about to have a child, which is probably the most carbon-intensive thing that we'll ever do in our lives. And to go along with the child, we're going to buy a new vehicle because we want to have a vehicle that's going to be a little safer. And I'm happy to say that the new vehicle we're going to get is going to get better fuel economy. And that sort of positive vision of the future, where we can say, look, we can do this. We can get higher mileage vehicles. We can, you know, get lower carbon electricity generation. I think that's going to be a much more positive and a much more successful vision than sort of trying to demonize fossil fuels, which I think just, you know, doesn't quite work.
You know, that reminds me of a joke that I saw on the net. How do Prius owners drive?
I don't know.
One hand on the wheel, the other patting themselves on the back. So look, can we find humor in climate change? Are we ready for climate change jokes, or at least to laugh at our fumbling selves?
I think we can certainly use it as a way to connect to audiences. I mean, as always, we need to be, you know, if I'm telling jokes about the recession, then I need to be careful to be respectful to people who have lost their jobs in the recession. But at the same time, I think we can laugh about our economic situation, and I think we can, you know, laugh about climate change issues also. I'll tell you one of my favorite jokes/stories is about the Washington Post columnist George Will, who's a pretty conservative fellow. He came to one of my classes a few years ago. He doesn't believe that humans are partly responsible for increasing global temperatures, but I asked him if he would support replacing part of the payroll tax, part of the employment tax in the U.S., with a carbon tax. And he said that he was all for it because he hates the payroll tax. You know, and with unemployment at 5 or 6%, 6 or 7%, I hate the payroll tax. Right? And Al Gore hates the payroll tax. Al Gore says we should tax what we burn and not what we earn. So I asked George Will what he thought about the fact that he and Al Gore agreed on this particular issue. And George Will said, well, he said, an idea should not be held responsible for the people who believe in it. Yeah, so that's a pretty good line, and there's content behind it. So if Al Gore and George Will can agree that kind of a revenue-neutral carbon tax swap is a good idea, then maybe there's hope after all.
I was trying to think of a couple of climate jokes as I was thinking about talking with you, and the things I came up with were pretty bad. Here's one. Two polar bears are at a bar when they run out of ice. Yeah. Ta-dum. Not very good. So, look, I'd be interested, Joram Bauman, in hearing about two of your directions. What are you looking at these days as an economist? That's my first question. And then what sort of projects do you have coming up as far as the comedy part of your life?
They're connected. So that the economics work that I do, I do a lot of policy work, especially here in Washington and Oregon, and I work in particular on carbon pricing, in particular on the idea that a revenue-neutral carbon tax is a good way to move forward with climate change in a bipartisan way. So this is a policy, actually, like I said earlier, the most successful climate policy in the world, I would argue, is the carbon tax up in British Columbia, passed by a right-of-center government, now supported by both of the major parties up there in British Columbia. And I think it's a terrific success story. It's reduced carbon emissions. It's arguably boosted the economy by allowing them to reduce personal and corporate income taxes. There's an offset for impacts on low-income households. So really, I think a very smart policy, and I spend a lot of time working with folks here in Washington State and elsewhere trying to explain how does that system work, how could you make it, you know, work for different sectors of the economy, for different income groups, for manufacturers, for low-income households. And I have a lot of optimism that an idea like that is kind of that its time has come. So I'm excited about that. I think on the comedy front, I'm continuing to develop new material. I'm putting together a list right now of sort of the top economics humor stories of all time. And believe it or not, there actually is competition on that list. But things like Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist who writes for the New York Times, about 30 years ago wrote an article looking at the economics of interstellar trade, because he's a big science fiction fan and also a trade theorist. And it's really a terrifically funny article. You can find it online if you're interested. It's called A Theory of Interstellar Trade. And so there are all these kind of little nuggets in the economics world. I'm not saying that all economists or even most economists are very funny. But if you look around, you will find some good examples of economic humor, and I'm sort of working on compiling some of those.
Great. Well, laugh if you want. We've been talking with Dr. Joram Bauman. He's come out of the ivory tower to explain everything from macroeconomics to climate change using comedy and cartoon books. His latest is The Cartoon Introduction to Climate Change, available in all the usual places. Follow Joram at his website, standupeconomist.com. Thank you so much for joining us, Joram.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.